We need a real investigation. I don't think we have one yet.
Yes, it's true. And yes, it is a crime.
Well, thank you, Cleta Mitchell. Thank you for that explanation. Really interesting and kind of appalling.
Thank you,
really.
Tucker.
Cleta Mitchell is somebody with great courage, and she's involved with your litigation and lawsuits and all of this stuff. She literally gave up her whole practice not to get paid. She saw how corrupt it was, how disgusting it was, how dirty it was. And I want to thank you on behalf of everybody in this room and everybody in this country. You are a hell of a lawyer and tough. And that's what we need.
Hi, I'm Cleta Mitchell, and I'm the host of Who's Counting, our podcast about all things election integrity. And we are thrilled today to have as our guest, Kim Strassel. So welcome, Kim.
Hi,
thank
Cleta.
You so much for being here,
it
dear friend.
And it's so joy.
Great to be with you. I want to start with a little bit of your background, because you have such a great, interesting background. You grew up in Oregon,
mm-hmm.
and I want you to tell the audience a little bit about life growing up in Oregon.
Well, so if you were looking at the photos of Portland these days, right. that was not the Oregon I grew up in. I grew up out toward the coast in a logging community. So it was a farming and logging community. And my dad, a blue-collar small business owner, he was an auto mechanic. Had four daughters. They gave up after that. They kept trying to have a son, four daughters. We were all brought up a little bit tomboyish, but it was a great upbringing. Yeah.
Well, I think I remember, and while it was a sad occasion when your dad passed away, but I think I remember that you sent around a picture of you and your sisters with guns and drinking some whiskey and celebrating, toasting your dad.
Yeah, no, we did very much. We all got our first guns when we were 12. We went hunting. Chainsaws. My dad made all of us a rule when we were growing up. If we wanted our own cars, we had to take them apart and put them back together again. So he was a real character, and we all learned a lot from him. It was a good, like I said, I was very fortunate to have the parents. My mom, she's still around. She's amazing.
And yeah. she's still in Oregon?
She's still in Oregon. And my sisters, yeah, most of my sisters are there. So they still are surviving the regime of
true.
Kate Brown. Yes.
That's right. And the crazy people in Portland.
And the crazy people. I don't think there's a lot of trips to Portland anymore.
Yeah. And then you went to Princeton.
Mm-hmm.
And so tell us about your college experience and how you then got to the Wall Street Journal.
Well, I was very fortunate to go to Princeton before things had become quite so PC as they are now. I mean, there was an element of it when I was there. But I loved every minute of it. I've always felt so fortunate and still have a lot of love for the place, especially some of the amazing professors there, like Robbie George,
correct.
For instance. But yeah, that was really fun. And then, but I had to work while I was in college to help pay for plane tickets back home and things, and met this amazing couple that were looking for someone to watch our children after school. And it was Karen House and Peter Kahn, who were very senior at the Wall Street Journal.
Oh, my goodness.
And when I went to graduate and I was uncertain what I wanted to do, and I thought about going to law school.
Oh, goodness.
They discouraged me. They said, if you don't go to law school just because you don't know what else you want to do,
right.
go out and spend a year in the world. And I ended up as the most junior of junior news assistants at our offices in Brussels.
Oh, how fabulous. Mm-hmm. You know, I have given, I gave the commencement speech at the University of Oklahoma Law School, mm-hmm. which is my alma mater. And that was one of the things I said. I know that many of you are graduated from law school because you went there because it was September.
Right.
That's
exactly.
basically what
yeah.
happened.
Right. You know, I mean, a lot of kids, too. The only thing you know that you're good at is going to school.
Right.
You know,
it's
so just keep going to school.
Just keep going. Well, so you've worked for the Wall Street Journal then ever since you graduated from college.
I think 26 years
is
now.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so how did you make your way to the editorial board?
Right. So I started on the news side. And I think a lot of people will be surprised by that. A lot of us who are on the editorial board or on the editorial page did start on the news side of the newspaper. And it's a great thing, because a lot of folks don't understand that we're a reported editorial page. You know, mm-hmm. our goal is to use information to persuade people and to break news ourselves in the process. So I was on the news site about 5 years. I'd moved back to New York and I'd always wanted to be on the editorial page.
Really?
It was always kind of my philosophy, free markets and free people. I think they were so shocked when I came from the news site and said I really wanted a job.
Oh, really? You approached them.
Well, there was an opening I'd heard about. Right. I had my interview with Bob Bartley, the famous editor of the Wall Street Journal. And luckily, they took me.
Oh, yeah. Isn't that great? So tell us about your responsibilities now.
So I am a member of the Wall Street Journal editorial board. And as such, I write a number of the unsigned editorials mm-hmm. that appear in the paper that where we speak as one voice, we, the Wall Street Journal editorial board. But then I'm also their Potomac Watch columnist. My job is to write a weekly column. It comes out on Fridays.
We always look forward to that.
Well, you know, the editorial columns often are about policy. Mm-hmm. You know, this tax policy is good or bad. Potomac Watch is meant to say politics. Mm-hmm. Like, what is happening behind the scenes? Why are the parties doing what they're doing? Or this leader or that leader? What are the stakes? That kind of thing. I've been doing it since 2006. So math is not my strong point, however long that is. A while now.
Well, that is a while now. Mm-hmm. How has it changed with COVID?
Well, obviously, all of us, you know, we're no longer in the office. Now, I'd been working remotely for a while. I split my time between a house I have in Alaska and Washington, D.C. So I did my hunkering down. That's what we called it up there.
Good.
And it was great. I've actually think it's been wonderful doing more of that, being able to watch Washington from among people who also watch Washington, you know, I mean, are that at a distance. When people talk about there being a little bit of a bubble here, it's totally true. And getting out of that is really important.
So you really are watching the Potomac from a distance.
From a distance, yeah.
That's good.
I get here a lot.
Right.
It's good to live and work among people for whom politics is not their daily thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So let's talk about you've written two books. Mm-hmm. Your book, The Intimidation Game, was about
which featured you,
which had some information about some things I was involved in. Talk a little bit about that, and then your second book, Resistance.
So I'm still really thrilled by that first book, only because it was meant to be an alert about 10 years ago that many on the left were beginning to use some very aggressive tactics that were designed to really shut down Americans' ability to engage in free speech, whether it was average Americans who were engaged in the Tea Party and the IRS intimidation mm-hmm. of them at the time, trying to force them out of working in elections or, you know, getting messages out at a time of elections, whether it is liberal prosecutors in states like Wisconsin, where they went over after groups like the Club for Growth, whether it was attacks on attacks on corporations, you know, through these proxy votes that they do mm-hmm. now, but all designed to push them out of the political sphere to make them shut down, not talk anymore. And we've only seen those tactics, you know, scaled up mm-hmm. and to the point now where we have cancel culture. You're no longer allowed to say certain things without risk of losing your job.
Right.
So what it was kind of meant to flag at the time, something that I found very disturbing and that you were seeing in many different forms. And now it's just de rigueur on yeah. the left in politics.
And there seems to be no stopping it.
No. I mean, well, actually, you can. I mean, one of the last things I wrote in that book is that the way you defeat this is you never get bullied into yeah. conceding that.
And well, that's
you,
true.
You never put down your First Amendment rights. And
right.
I think we are seeing some backlash to it now, and that's because people are sick of it and they're not taking it anymore.
Well, I will say, having gone through the cancel culture myself and my 20-year partnership at my law firm, and they came after my law firm and me, and so I resigned. And what's interesting is when I now am looking, I had occasion a couple of weeks ago to look for some photos for the podcast
that
you know, on the internet, And the headline most often about me is how my career was ruined, and that I guess people think that I'm dead. But it's really funny. I think it is what you say. You can't let them bully you. Mm-mm. And it was all because of my representation of President Trump in the post-election in Georgia. And I guess if you're, someone wrote to me and said, it's too bad you were representing the president. If only you'd just been representing Al-Qaeda, it would have been fine. But I think your point is you can't let them make you stop.
No. Oh my gosh. That's in fact what they're betting on and banking on. And the more people who refuse mm-hmm. to be pigeonholed or to in any way just stop talking, that's the way you defeat it.
I think that's right.
You get the truth out.
All right. So that leads into your second book, Resistance.
Yeah. And that was very much, you know, the entire 4 years of the Trump presidency, even the time leading up to it, we have heard this constant refrain that this was a president who was breaking all institutional norms, its administration. You know, I make the case that if you look back, the president was himself, in terms of his personal demeanor, definitely norm breaking. You know, we had never had a president like that before. And, you know, I think if you talk to a lot of conservatives, that wasn't necessarily like some of his behavior, not their favorite aspect of mm-hmm. him at times. You know, they were able to say, eh. But if you look at the administration, it was very principled, very law abiding, very conservative policy oriented. They had some of the best people in the business in part because Mike Pence did a lot of the recruiting and the initial people who were named, and he was very much deeply in that world.
That's true. He was very embedded in the conservative movement.
Absolutely. And, you know, the things that were accomplished in terms of tax policy and regulatory reform, you know, no one had thought something like that could happen.
Energy independence.
For years. So that part, but if you step back and you look around, it was the resistance to Donald Trump on the left that ended up doing all the norm breaking, you know, watering down the rules of impeachment, the Bob Mueller Russia collusion conspiracy hoax. Mm-hmm. Which really did damage to media institutions and, you know, contempt of Congress.
And the FBI.
So, and the FBI and damage in just institutions all over the place. So that was the idea behind that book.
Well, you did a wonderful job of documenting that. And, you know, one of the things I think is really important that is that as we go forward is that we continue to document the truth.
Yes.
You know, we just have to continue to document that, which brings me to the 2020 election.
Yeah.
You have written to me the most important piece being that didn't just start on November the 3rd. Talk about, I think one of the pieces you wrote was harvesting the 2020 mm-hmm. election. Talk about your thesis and what you observed and why you think it all happened the way it did.
Well, as we all know, there was a lot of fear out there among many conservative voters that very bad things had happened on election day. My point was that actually the real problem was leading the months, in fact, more than a year leading up to Election Day.
Almost 2 years.
2 years. People forget that one of the first things that Democratic Congress did, Nancy Pelosi did when she retook the House in 2018, the first thing was H.R. 1, mm-hmm. their first H.R. 1, which was this bill, which they continued to push to basically federalize elections and to institute across the country California's election regime.
And talk about what that is.
So it's basically same day voter registration, no real voter ID anywhere, ballot harvesting, allowing other people to bring in, be paid to bring in other people's ballots. I think the list goes on. All mail-in voting mm-hmm, across the mm-hmm. country. All these things that they have found in California, by the way, and we can talk about this some, does not increase voter turnout, but does embed Democratic politicians for life. There's a system that they have worked out that they know caters to their particular voter base. And if you can institute it, it almost guarantees that you can have Democrats elected again and again.
And never lose power.
And never lose power. And so they passed this bill. It didn't I mean, it didn't go through the Senate because Mitch McConnell was still running the Senate. But when COVID hit, it became their pretext to then begin implementing pieces of it on an emergency basis all across the country. And that's essentially what they did. It was no accident that within weeks of COVID and lockdowns, you had Democratic attorneys filing dozens, hundreds of lawsuits at every level of state governments. And then when that didn't work, going and getting elected officials that were on their side to impose the requirements that they wanted. This was all with great purpose. And it created a system that was not a level playing field that advantaged Democrats in the election.
Well, and even getting some Republican elected officials to go along with them out of fear, intimidation, wanting to be liked and that sort of thing, which is what one of the things that happened in Georgia.
Right.
But, you know, one of the things that I've had a lot of conversations with people about the election, and I know that there are a lot of people out there who say the Chinese hacked the machines. And I will just tell you from my experience in Georgia, what I finally see, I looked around the table with our volunteer team, and I'm an election law attorney. And so I know that if you want to challenge an election, you have to be, you can't just say,
right,
oh, they were mean to me, or this wasn't fair. You have to say, this is John Doe, registered at this address. This is an illegal vote.
Right.
This is Jane Smith, mm-hmm. registered at this address. This is an illegal vote.
Right.
And so that's what we did. And I said, we're not going to talk about the voting machines because
right.
I can barely work my iPhone.
Yeah.
And there's no one sitting around this table who's an expert. And so we did a word search. I said, do a word search. I want to make sure Dominion is not mentioned in mm-hmm. our lawsuit.
Right.
But then we never got our day in court. Because the judge was never appointed to hear our case.
Mm.
And one of the things that I say to people about 2020 is you can look for whether that's the Chinese hacking the machines. You can look, you can make yourself crazy doing that. But what I think happened is that they did it sort of right out in front of us.
Right.
Right before our very eyes.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and you can spend your time feeling frustrated about that Chinese theory, which again, we don't have any proof.
We don't yet. Nobody's seen it yet.
No, exactly. And so you can do that, or you can recognize that this is really more of a political fight. And it's one that requires people to reengage mm-hmm. With their electoral systems, with these laws. Look, I've been very pleased to see what happened in Georgia and in Texas. The voting reform laws that they have passed, which, by the way, they had to stand up against complete baloney
nonsense
press coverage and claims and
Jim
Crow laws.
Speaking of corporations.
Yes, exactly. Oh, my gosh. Major League Baseball, all of these different companies. Look, the Georgia system is still 10 times easier to vote in Georgia than it is in Joe Biden's Delaware. You know? And for Joe Biden to stand up and say this is Jim Crow, it was absolutely ludicrous. He didn't even get pushback on that. So, but they've instituted laws that are the perfect idea, which is we need a balance between voter access to the polls, and integrity, so that people can feel both that they can go vote and that it's not difficult, but that they have faith in the system and that we can squash down these theories of Chinese hacking. Because it just discourages people to go out in the end.
Well, and that is, I think, one of the things that did happen in Georgia in the Senate runoff. Because, and I said to the Republican establishment, you know, who were pivoting to the runoff moments after the mm-hmm. The presidential election, and I said, people, if the Trump voters don't see you walking barefoot across broken glass
right.
about what happened last Tuesday, number one, the Democrats are going to do it again. And number two, they're not going to go out and vote again. And I think there was so much anger at the Republican establishment in Georgia because they really didn't help with the challenges that they could have. And really what we needed was we needed the Secretary of State to say, all right, there are these allegations. Let's sit down. Let's look at your data, and we'll look at our data, and we'll try to reconcile it. And they would never do that. And so that was a huge problem, that he was just constantly wanting to play to the media and the media become a media darling by fighting with the president.
I think we do have this big question going forward about how do you have real transparency in election? I mean, you put your finger on something that really is behind a lot of the lack of confidence, is that no one really understands how these things work.
And they should.
We've made them very, very complicated. You know, you started getting all of these theories coming out about explanations of how the voting systems work. And it was mind-boggling in some situations. And we have this, or at least I have this sort of naive view that, you know, somewhere there's some counter somewhere and you just go in and push this button and then there's a record. But it's as you know, it's vastly more complicated than that.
But it needn't be. And one of the things that I agree with you, if we do not restore transparency in the process, and I was actually speaking with a consultant to Dominion who lives in San Francisco, and he said that the system is capable of posting the ballots on a real time ballot images on a real time basis, and they do that in San Francisco. So my question is, and it doesn't, by that point it doesn't have any identification as to who cast
did
the ballot,
right?
But you can see the images. And I'm thinking, why don't we just do that everywhere? That seems to make so much sense to me.
We have to be looking around at best practices across the country. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's, we talk about this all the time. It's the beauty of the United States, 50 different systems. Mm-hmm. And even within that, at precinct levels and, you know, more local levels, people trying, doing innovative things, places that are also doing things that we don't like either. Right. But we need to be having a kind of discussion about model transparency, model voting, model security, all of the things that go into both access and integrity.
Well, and that's the thing that is so worrisome to me is, and I was going to ask you this, you're in the media industry. Thank goodness you're not like 99.9999% of the people in the industry, but one of the frustrations is I see these articles, and I know that there's a real divide between the editorial pages of the Wall Street Journal and the news pages, but there is just this unwillingness to even, I mean, the reporters use the Democrats' language to describe these bills that have been passed by Georgia and Texas. They call them voting restrictions.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. This has been my frustration for years and years. I mean, I used to get so annoyed because I grew up where I did in a logging community. And, you know, you used to have members of the press that would just write anytime you changed an environmental law. Mm-hmm. They would say rolling back environmental protections.
Right, rolling back.
You know, I mean, so this has been going on for years and years. I do think that what's changed, though, and you know, I have a lot of admiration for our reporters on the Wall Street Journal. I think we do a really good job. But a lot of media outlets out there, one of the great disappointments to me over the last is we're no longer pretending that this is unconscious bias, to use the word, you know,
to borrow a phrase,
you know, that used to be the theory that there was just a lot of people at these papers and they all talked to each other and they were a little bit of a bubble and they all kind of leaned a certain way and that they didn't even realize that they were, you know, acting in a biased way. Well, I think we can all put that aside. I mean, there's now agenda news out there and most organizations have simply given up on attempting any type of neutrality in journalism.
So if you were going to give a talk to a group of concerned citizens about the 2020 election, what would be your message to them? What do you say to them? Here's what I think happened, and here's what I think you can do about it.
So I would say, as we were just discussing, that Democrats for a long time have had a plan about how they want voting to operate. You know, and just to give one little example here about how you can use these things to help your side, as it were. You know, Karl Rove had a great column for us in the Journal talking about the recent Texas reform law and what it moved back to the rules prior to 2020. And one of the things Democrats have wanted is 24-hour voting, but they only had it in certain places. There were like seven facilities, all in places that just happen to have a lot of Democratic voters. And that's kind of an example. It sounds good on its head. Well, why wouldn't we want 24-hour voting? But if you're using it just to sort of help your side, that's not, you know, that's rigging the system, as it were. You know, we need to have equal rules, et cetera. So understand that this was going on for a long time and that there was a plan. Okay. Understand that they're now trying to institute this at a federal level via HR 1 and HR 4, another voting rule. And then, so both be engaged at that, at a federal level. Make sure that your senators in your state are not on board with throwing over your state's rights and having the federal government take over all voting rules, but get involved locally. Go to your meetings for your elections board, run for local government, you know, act, go to one of these new growing training sessions where you learn to be a responsible election observer, and take part in that process.
Well, that, I'm glad to hear you say that, because that is one of the things the Election Integrity Network at CPI is doing, is that we are conducting training. We're soon to publish a citizen's guide to election integrity, a citizen's guide to the election laws in your state. I mean, we're going to have a series of citizen's guides so that people will have the tools and be equipped to put eyes in every election office in the country, because the left has been infiltrating and insinuating itself into these election offices, and we've somehow just delegated that and thought it was all just going to work just fine.
Yeah.
But I that's what, so, I mean, you're basically reiterating what I've come to believe, which is it's not China. It's not the voting machines. No. It's the fact that they've had a plan, and they've had a plan, and they've been doing it. And we just have to be there. We have to show up.
Right. Exactly. and care. Like I said, it's very important to care what's going on here in Washington and the federal government. But I say this to everyone all the time, like, gosh, if there's something you can do on a day-to-day basis, go to your school board meetings.
Right. A lot of people are doing that now.
Yeah, now they are. And that's great. But the founders understood that the government that was supposed to matter really was the government that was closest to you. You know, a local and a state government. If we were doing this better, we shouldn't even be watching many headlines come out of a federal government. They've got too much power as it is. So let's bring that power back.
Well, there's one thing I did want to ask you about. You live in Alaska now, and one of the things that the left has been busily doing all over the country are all these different changes in how we vote, when we vote, the way we vote. And they've come up with something that they put on the ballot in Alaska, ranked choice voting. It's the same thing that they got passed in Maine. It sounds good. Most people don't know what it is. We watched it play out in the New York City mayoral race, which was a mess. Talk to us about that, and how do we stop some of these things?
Yeah, so New York, I was actually thrilled to see the mess of New York, because, all you hear for years is ranked choice, and it's so much cleaner and so much more efficient. Actually, there's a lot of scenarios in which it's very disenfranchising to people. It's needlessly complex. It's a discouragement to many people to go out to vote. There's a lot of problems with it, but thankfully, that race magnified all of those, put them out there so that people could see, just what a problem it is. Unfortunately for we in Alaska, that hadn't happened yet by the time this was on the ballot last year. It barely squeaked through.
I'm betting there was not much paid opposition to it.
No, well, the people who were promoting it, I got mail every day. You know, my mailbox was stacked. This was and all of the usual sort of suspects on sort of more left-leaning groups really, really pushing this. But I can't tell you how many people I know, my friends and neighbors, who called and said, "What is this ranked choice voting?" And it sounds good to me, because no one understands it. So I think if there had been more paid opposition to it, it wouldn't have passed. And I also believe that there is going to be a lot of buyer's remorse next year. I know there's a lot of folks in Alaska talking about getting it back, but it's too late to get it back on the ballot, I believe, already for next year. And even if you did, you'd have to go through the process on the next ballot at least one time. So there's a lot of discussions about how to move forward. And I think a lot of hope for those who have problems with it, that maybe after one time with this, Alaskans will say, "That was a bad idea."
So are you working on a book now?
I've got ideas floating through my head, but as you know, this has been a wild 18 months. And, you know, from COVID to the election to more recently the new administration and Afghanistan. And it's just, it doesn't seem to end. So we'll get there at some point.
Well, but, you know, if people just read your column every Friday, that's better than a book. Or it's certainly as good as, because you give the best commentary. And I do urge people to read Potomac Watch. And you have a podcast. There's a Potomac Watch podcast.
Yep. 3 times a week. Yep. Yes. We do that. And Journal Editorial Report on Fox. Yep. It's a fun thing to watch. So they keep us pretty busy.
Yeah, they do. Well, Kim, you are a true national treasure. Thank you so much spending time with us. And good luck on whatever it is you're doing, as we'll all be watching and listening.
Well, thanks for all you do, too.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to Who's Counting. The Who's Counting podcast is produced by the Conservative Partnership Institute's Election Integrity Network. It is filmed and recorded at CPI Studios in Washington, D.C. Editing is by Creative Patriots. Please help us grow this podcast by sharing this episode with a friend. We rely on your word of mouth to get the word out, because big tech can't be trusted. They try to cancel us daily, and they don't want us talking on social media about election fraud. Help fight back by visiting our website, www.whoscounting.us, and sign up for our Election Integrity newsletter, subscribe to our podcast, and get the real election integrity news.